do these things?
That's a joke.
Okay, folks. Marat Rabotai, cherished colleagues. I assume you saw our subject. I saw a poster that most people are afraid of heights, not me. I'm afraid of widths. Climbing a mountain is a metaphor for soaring obstacles. But ultimately, the great fear, the greatest boogeyman, is not making commitment. By way of analogy, Orthodox people have two phobias, right? One is washing, and the other is becoming milchik. Fleshik, I'm sorry. Those are two phobias. And it's either 4 seconds or 6 hours, but we can't deal with it. So when we speak of commitment, it reminds me of a story. A frum lady made a commitment to go on a diet, not tomorrow, but today. And no sooner she made the commitment to go on a diet, and she was driving down the road past the bakery, and there staring from the window was Napoleon oozing custard. Knew, she said, must be bashert. But then again, I did make this commitment to go on a diet, but then again, God did arrange this fortuitous encounter between the Claire and myself. I know, I'll wait for a sign from above. I know, if I find a parking space in front of the bakery, then I will know it's meant for me to eat the Napoleon. And sure enough, on her eighth time round the block, she found a parking space in front of the bakery. Commitment means hell or high water, right? You commit to Daf Yomi, it's not every other day. It's a daily commitment. You volunteer for Hatzolah, it means Friday night, it means on a Yom Tov meal, it means in the middle of a business meeting.
Right.
It's not, we don't believe in three day a year Jews. Before Moshe Rabbeinu could accept the Torah, he had to scale the mountain. Now, even though Sinai was the most modest of all the mountains, figuratively, there's always a mountain to scale. And when I started thinking about this, it was then that I knew what I wanted to talk about. The idea of scaling a mountain got me thinking in terms of visual metaphors. And this led me to one of the Rambam's most famous, if not the most famous, ruling of the Rambam, which is fundamental 101 background, which is indicated before the Rambam. And that background is our perspective towards money. There's a story that a strong man in a circus came out, and his first act was he put his hand right through a wall of concrete. And the second act, he lifted up this enormous weight way above his head. And the third act, he took a lemon, and he squeezed it and kvetched it, and there was a torrent of juice, then a few drops, and then not one more drop. And then the circus manager came out and said, whoever can get one more drop out of this lemon, I'll give them two crisp $100 bills. So these two buff guys look up there, they go, and not a drop. They said, anybody else? And then this slight old man with large frame glasses bent over, comes over, and the whole audience is snickering. He takes the lemon, and there is a cascade of juice coming out of it. He said, what's your name and what do you do? He said, my name is Seymour Goldstein, and I'm a fundraiser for the UJA. So, the background, the 101 is like this. The background goes like this. Since all property is ultimately God's and not man's, charity is therefore a commandment and not a favor. And that's the very word itself, tzedakah. That's why in Lashon HaKodesh, the word which means justice, means charity. So the Torah perspective is, which is really opposed to the world at large, we don't own our money, but we're trustees or proprietors over our money. And as a trustee, behooves us to act in a way that's appropriate and faithful to the stewardship. By way of analogy, you have two individuals. I'm making this analogy extremely simple. You have one man who is a charlatan, and it says on a slogan t-shirt, illegit, faker. He knocks on the door of good-hearted Sam, could you please give to my disreputable, fictitious charity? Good-hearted Sam rips out his wallet and hands him $10. That's case A. Case B, you have a forthright, stellar individual collecting for a legitimate tzedakah, says on a slogan t-shirt, legit, and he knocks on the door of tight-fisted Charlie. He said, could you please give it to my wonderful orphanage in Jerusalem? And Tight-Fisted Charlie slams the door in his face. So who is worse, Tight-Fisted Charlie or Good-Hearted Sam? Let's hear it for Charlie. Let's hear it for Sam. By the way, would I ask a trick question? Of course. And the answer is, to a certain perspective, say they are both the same. Just like Charlie had no right to deny a worthwhile, forthright stucca, likewise, Sam had no right to squander stucca geld on a reputable stucca. This can only be understood if you fathom we don't own the money, but we're trustees over the money. And this is something that a non-Jew or someone who's not observant will have a hard problem understanding. What do you mean you don't drive on Saturday? Do you own the car? I own it, but there's rules. You don't watch your TV, your neighbor's TV on Saturday? I don't, because there's rules which govern. Okay. Only if we understand this can we understand what's coming up. Then comes Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler says the world is divided between givers and takers. The givers are always giving, and the takers are always giving. And there isn't a lot of time, and I'm speaking as quickly as I can. I don't know if you can keep up with my velocity. I'm trying to get an hour's worth, even though I never gave this talk before, in 44 minutes. But divide between givers and takers. In other words, let's say you want to give and give and give, and you decide you're going to open up a makolet, a grocery store, and not charge. So everybody, all the people learning, will have food. That's not a good idea. In 3 days, you'll be out of business. But if you're clever, what you'll do is you'll figure out how you can charge a skin profit, and that way you're giving, and even when you're taking, you're giving, because you're always giving. But what is a taker doing? He's always taking. But no one wants to give money and not get anything in return. So they're figuring out, how can I give the lowest return for the greatest intake? And even when they're giving, they're taking. That's the Dessler's principle. And it goes further. And this is what's called in yeshiva, a chakira. What's a chakira? What's an analysis? What is a zebra? Is it a black horse with white stripes? Or a white horse with black stripes? We can spend weeks on this. I'm being nice. We can spend years on this, you know. That's a chakira. So, the chakira goes like this. Do you give because you love? Or do you love because you give? Why do parents provide for their children? Because they love them? Or because they love them, they give to them? And Rav Dessler proves hermetically that giving is a function, that love is a function of giving. And the more you give, the more you love. So much so, he says, if there's someone you don't get along with, it would be a wise idea to give to them, and that could alter the relationship. And I think that's, where we blow it on Purim time. Who to give Shalach Manas to? Our neighbors, our friends, the people we love. And if you have that landlord you don't get along with, and you give him a nice Shalach Manas, that could alter the relationship. It's a Beferish of Dessler. Okay. And the mandate of a parent is to love all children the same. Now, Rav Dessler does not say this. I hope that I'm not being presumptuous, but I think if I could present this to him, he would agree with me. And that is, if parents were to have a special child, I think they would love that one the most because they give that one the most. And my friend told me a story that in Jerusalem there's a couple which has a girl with an unusual ailment. I don't even know what it is. And this fellow who is a Yerushalmi, with all the trappings, langa rekel, bulletproof stockings, hat large enough to be a shiloh of Ohel and Shabbos, even though without any secular education, became extremely knowledgeable about this malaise. And there was a conference in Jerusalem in the Plaza Hotel of doctors in the specialty. And he attended the sessions, and he looked very odd there. It's all these doctors, you know, with the steths and the white coats, and he's with the langel-reckel and the whole. And he went to the lead professor, and he's talking to him, and the professor saw, this guy really knows what he's talking about. The professor was Jewish, and this Yerushalmi, this Jerusalemite, invited him to his house for the Friday night meal. And he accepted the invitation, and said, I'm just cautioning you, that my daughter, who has the ailment, you will not be able to discover which one she is. We've worked with her so well, you'll never know the difference. So he came to his house, and Friday night, after the meal, he walked his guest back to the Plaza Hotel. He said, tell me, which is the one which has the disease? And the professor said, Chavi. He said, how did you know? Because I saw when you gave a blessing Friday night to the children, there was more love in your eyes when you gave her a blessing when you gave to the others. And the more you give, the more you love. Okay, so finally we're down up to where I want to get to us. And that is the most famous ruling of the Rambam, which is the levels of charity, which are composed of 8 levels. And I want to ascribe to this a visual metaphor, which works perfectly for me, and that is, I'm calling it the Rambam's ladder. And rung by rung, we're going to climb this ladder. And the idea is, of the visual metaphor, that there's giving, and there's giving. And the Rambam's ladder is laid out in rungs of descending order, from the most worthy on down. The anonymous giver ranks above the giver who is known. Giving before being asked ranks above those who give when they're asked. The lowest level belongs to the grudging giver, and the summit belongs to the person who helps out the poor man become self-sufficient. So the Rambam starts at the top, from the highest level of giving, works his way down, moving from realism, pardon me, from idealism to realism. The highest level of tzedakah is the rung on top, giving a person a job. And the standard loan at the turn of the century, I don't mean 19 years ago, in the East End of London was £5, because that was enough money to buy a sewing machine, enable a person to become self-sufficient. On a macro level, Rav Moshe Feinstein rules that the most important education to give is vocational education and professional training. That way you can make a person create their own livelihood. The building material for every step on the Rambam's ladder is consciousness, anonymity, self-sufficiency, absence of reluctance, and never inflicting shame. All of these ideas mandate an awareness of our own common humanity. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker, New York, the literary one. This audience doesn't even know. Okay, New York. New York Magazine. The literary one, not the cheap one. So there's a cartoon, and it shows this man with a cashmere coat and a briefcase and a nice hat on his head. And next to him is a man with stubble on his face, his teeth are disfigured. And he says to the fellow with his hand out, he has his hand out, he says, "It's not like I'm asking you to acknowledge our common humanity." And the most famous example of the Rambam's highest level is the fisherman. If I give you a fish, I solved your meal. I teach you how to fish, I've given you a livelihood. The second highest step in the Rambam's ladder is when the donor doesn't know who is giving to, and the recipient doesn't know who made the donation. And that's the standard way it works when you give money to an organization to distribute to the poor. You don't know who you're giving to, and the poor don't know who's making the donation. Now, this anonymity was the foolproof way of protecting the pact with God. It avoids hurt feelings, it eliminates praise, because in ancient times, achieving righteousness was not the goal of almsgiving, right? It wasn't to make a tax deduction or self-aggrandizement. It was good for the sake of good. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the name of Rabbi Yitzchak David Grossman, who runs an educational network in Israel in the north. And he is in a town that was, thank you very much. This is how you got me there. Thank you very much. Thanks to the whole Haberman family. So Rav Yitzchak David Grossman is in a town that was infested with crime. It's a development town, which is a Israeli euphemism for a undeveloped town. And Migdal Emek, as Rabbi Grossman points out, means tower of death, tower of dark. So he created an educational network there called Migdal Or, a tower of light. In the 1970s, Jacob and Belle Rosenbaum were visiting Beit She'an, which is a tourist attraction. They wanted some kosher food. They said, "Why don't you go to Rabbi Grossman?" So they went there, they came to his house, and they did a triple take. Here's a Yerushalmi, transplanted out of Mea Shorim, again, with a Langel Rekel, hat large enough to be a shayla of Ohel on Shabbos, bulletproof stockings. And there's everyone there, they call him the disco rabbi, looking there straight out of the disco. Unruly, wild youth. Nothing of this looks like a rabbi's house. And Rabbi Grossman points to this girl. See this girl, Sarah? This Sarala is going to be the very best. Right now, she's missing direction. Now, the Rosenbaums did a few double takes, and they bought into it. And they said, Rabbi Grossman, come to America. I'm going to take off 2 weeks of work and I'll take you around and I'll help you raise money. This was in the early 1970s. He came to America. It was his very first time flying. He took off work and he raised for him $50,000, which was a lot of money then. And that's how began Migdal Or. And from the time Migdal Or was created, the police statistics are that crime went down from overwhelming, it went down by 90%. He started off with 18 boys and 11 girls. And then these people came, they spent the whole day eating bread and bread and bread. Their hygiene was appalling. They never took showers. They were always hungry. And now today there's over 6,000 enrolled in Migdal Or with over 20,000 graduates. Over 900 employees, 90% of them are graduates of Migdal Or. That's all thanks to the philanthropy of the Rosenbaums. Police statistics I've already told you. Okay, the next lowest rung of the Rambam's ladder is when the donor knows who the recipient is, but the recipient doesn't know the identity of the donor. The name Nathan Strauss, a name you may be familiar with, he was named after Netanya. That's a little joke. Nathan Strauss is a tremendous philanthropist. In 1893, when there was a financial panic in America, he established financial distribution centers to keep people, no matter how hard they were in their luck, with their dignity. He saw that handouts robbed people their dignity, so he didn't give out the food. He charged pennies. He sold 25 pounds of coal for a nickel. He gave out turkeys for a penny. He funded 30,000 meals for 1 cent each. He created dining rooms where they didn't charge. When World War I was looming, he sold his yacht to the Coast Guard and used the proceeds for war orphans. And then in 1904, he came to Israel and became a staunch Zionist. He could not stop hatching ideas how to give to Israeli poor, which is why they named Netanya after him, as well as Rehov Strauss in Jerusalem. He labored for Hebrew University. Lower yet is when the poor person knows who the giver is, but the donor doesn't know who the recipient is. It's hard for me to imagine the greatest philanthropist of the Jewish people. I hope your gears are turning. The greatest philanthropist of the Jewish people. Yeah. But you're afraid to say who he was.
You can tell.
I'm going to tell you. But I'm just creating a sense of drama. And it's hard for me to put him in a middle rung when actually he's got a condominium all the way on top. But he's in the middle over here. And his name is Moses Montefiore. From his retirement until the day he died, he devoted himself to philanthropy, practically alleviating the distress of Jews abroad. He went to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire in 1840 to liberate Jews from Syrian prison. He liberated the Jews of Damascus. He stopped a blood libel. He went to Rome in 1858 to free Jewish youth caught by the church. He went to Russia in 1846 and received by the Tsar. He went to Morocco in 1872 and 1864. It's an endless story. In 1867, he went to Romania. He became a folk hero. He was called the Tsar, the prince. And then he's worried about the Jews of Israel. They need to have a livelihood. And he wanted to establish them with a place in their own homeland. When he was 100 years old, he came to Israel for his sixth trip, and he raised the Kotel. And he repaired Kever Rachel. He built a Montefiore windmill to give flour to those in Yamin Moshe. And the Jews of the old city, they called him just the Tsar. Now, if I had a voice, I would love to sing to you Yoram Gaon's song, but just a few lyrics, which there's no time to cry. When he turned already 80 years old, the angels came to him and said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you. HaKadosh Baruch Hu rotzeh otcha elav. And he said to them, Montefiore said, Bidiyuk, he said to them, Salchuli rabotai, ach bemet ani asuk. I'm sorry, but I'm too busy. There's a pogrom in Russia. How can I go now to God? I'm too busy taking care of the people down here. So when Montefiore turned 90, they tried again. Ta'alek yisham lemala mevakshim. Because above, that's where they're asking for you. And he said to them, Hagidu li echuchal, how can I do it? Ech alilat adam b'damesek tevutal. How can I stop the blood libel in Damascus? And one time after another time, and he's already a hunt, and they say, come on, come on. It's time to go. And he said, I have to raise the Kotel Maravi. So when he turned 100, and in one more year, they came from above, and they couldn't take it. They just kissed him on the head. Time is up. The next level in the Rambam is when you give to someone before being asked. If you know someone who has unusual debts, most particularly this would be if someone has an unusual medical situation, if you can get to them before they have to start asking around and save them the anxiety and the embarrassment, that will be the Rambam's application. The Chafetz Chaim wrote a teeny weeny itsy bitsy little book called Avas Chesed, or in English, Avath Chesed. And he wrote there that everyone can open a gemach. Everyone can loan money to others. I said, what? He wrote this in incredulous Ukrainian word. How in the world can we loan that? I said, simple. Classic Chafetz Chaim. The depths of simplicity. All you have to do is save one kopeck a month. The end of the year, you have a ruble. Then the 5 years, you have 5 rubles. That's a tiny enough figure to loan to others. Came a snowflake and a snowball, and it avalanched. I live in Jerusalem, but I'm sure there's many other cities like this where there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of gemachim. From the classic money, you can walk through the Mir Yeshiva where I learn and can walk out with $10,000 from people who are penniless, loaning it to others. And there's a diaper gemach, and there's a chicken gemach. Thursday night, you're cooking, you run out of chickens, and a sheitel gemach. I don't know about that one. Okay, there's a... When Rabbi Wein was a student in Chicago in yeshiva, the boys that were dating pooled together their money to make one fancy Delancey tie. So a girl was on a date and she said, I dated that tie once before. There's a gemach in Israel, the length and the breadth of the country. What am I referring to? In Israel, in Jerusalem alone, there's over 15 branches. The length and the breadth of the country. It's called Yad Sara. Founded by Jerusalem's former mayor, Urla Polyansky, in honor of his mother, whose name was not Yad. And it's medical equipment from prosaic bedpans and wheelchairs to equipment you could never pronounce and certainly never afford. And it's changed the whole country. There's a lost kid gemach. You can't just go there and get, well, I go there all the time, but if you lose a kid, there's one central location to bring a lost kid, or if you find a kid, to bring it to. It changed the world. What the Chafetz Chaim wrote. I read a story once that weddings, I don't know about here in the Five Towns, but in Mea Sharim, in Williamsburg, where they have a poor table. In Europe, it was standard operating procedure. And that's how poor people got a meal. And they didn't want to sit at the poor table. And they went to the Baal Simcha and said, Herzog Chaim, if you don't let us sit with everyone else, we're boycotting the wedding. And that was extortion. Because how can you make a wedding without the poor people? They gave in to them. They sat with everyone else. Okay. We're up to now the penultimate lowest rung. That's giving less than what the people need, but in a pleasant way. And the lowest level, and you give them what they need, but in a morose way. So I asked my students in seminary, what's better? The guy needs 100, and you give him $5. And you say, I'm sorry, but... have it. I can't wait to give it to you. What are you saying? Take 100. So they all said, much better to give it with a nice face. So I said, if you're the poor man, what would you prefer?
100.
All right, so it was a big debate. Okay. The ground beneath the Rambam's ladder is always shifting. And that's why he wrote so many laws to make sure that it's done in a way to always protect those that need. The Rambam has educated countless generations that when you give, you get. And Rav Dessler only enhanced this. Now, this philanthropic act would apply to everyone, but when it comes to Israel, hence the tie into the Maiden Bounds. I had to get into my lovely new time, getting the Zionist part. These are our priorities. The first thing is to give to your family, to those in your own city, and the poor of Israel have the same status as those of your own city. In other words, if you live in Chicago, you have to give to Chicago before you give to Milwaukee. You live in Milwaukee, give to Milwaukee. But the poor of Israel have the status of your own city. There's something very distasteful about one who doesn't support the brother. There was a very wealthy Jew who had never given to the United Jewish Appeal. So a delegation went to him and said, Herzog Chaim Goldstein, listen here, we've been watching you. And we know that you have this mansion, you don't have any mortgage on this mansion. And not only do you own this home, you have a home in Palm Springs. And we know that you have a chalet in Switzerland. And you drive a Rolls and your wife has a Mercedes. And we know that this very year you opened up 12 stores. Goldstein sits through the entire speech and he says, you think you really checked up on me? And you think you really know me? Do you know about my mother who's in the hospital? She's got a heart condition. She needs constant care around the clock, which nursing doesn't provide. And did you find out about my uncle who's in an insane asylum who I have to take care of? And how about my brother-in-law who's a jerk? He sent two of his kids to this really fancy college and they don't take scholarships. And if I didn't give a penny to them, you think I'm going to give a penny to you? Okay. So there's also a well-known story in the yeshiva circles about the Kapitschinsky Rebbe who went to the office of one of his balabatim in Midtown, and he comes to the office and the Rebbe, and pardon me, and the businessman is so surprised to see the Rebbe. He said, please, Rebbe, why did you have to come here? He said, I need to speak to you about money for someone. He said, Rebbe, please, all you have to do is raise the phone. I'll do whatever you say. He said, no, there's a family which is in very dire straits. And please, Rebbe, you didn't have to come to my office. You could have just made that phone call. And so he said, well, I have to speak to you about this personally. Just tell me how much I should give, and it's done. Well, that's a personal decision for you to make. Can I write a check? He said, of course. To whom? And the Rebbe's voice dropped and he said quietly, write the check to your brother. Rabbi Wein told me a story just 2 weeks ago that the Bain in yeshivas in Europe, the towns, was there was a fire that would burn down half the town. So Chafetz Chaim wanted to turn his yeshiva into a fireproof building. He went to the gevir of the town, the wealthiest man. He said, I need your money. And he gave him a Lilliputian donation. Very, very tidy, very small donation. Then came World War I, and the Chafetz Chaim and his yeshiva went into exile. And in that exile, he met this wealthy man. The Chafetz Chaim tried to disguise himself. The man shouldn't see him, because the man was left with nothing. And he found the Chafetz Chaim, and he grabbed him by the lapels, and he said, I have tremendous critique against you. Against me? He said, yes. He said, you should have ripped the money out of me. Okay, so we have now like 4 minutes. So listen as quickly as you can. My point is, time and again, especially when we're talking about Israel, time and again when we give to others, ultimately we're giving to ourselves. This story I heard from my daughter who works for United Hatzalah. There's a woman in Chicago who lost her brother in an automobile. I don't know how she lost her brother. And she wanted to memorialize him by donating an ambulance cycle for United Hatzalah. And this is not a wealthy family. And she saved penny by penny and dollar by dollar. And after 4 years, she's able to make this donation. There was a terrible accident in Beit Sha'an. The first responder was an ambulance cycle from United Hatzalah. And it was a car filled with youth and pulling out one kid after another kid. And one of the kids, he looks up, and on the back of the ambulance cycle was emblazoned the name of his uncle. And it's thanks to the money that she gave that her son was saved. We're going to have to skip a little bit, not that you would know. In the late 1800s, the Netziv was the famous Rosh Hashiva of Lozhin. His youngest son's name was?
We don't know.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
His youngest son's name was Meir Bar Ilan. He was Ma'avrei, he Hebraized Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, Netziv. He Hebraized his name from Berlin to Bar Ilan. Of course, he's named after the university, which is ridiculous. He's actually named after the street. And his older brother's name is Chaim. Chaim is named after the yeshiva in Coney Island Avenue, Chaim Berlin. And because I'm a teacher for 100 points, the difference in age between the two, a mere 52 years, with a different wife in the middle. Okay. So, the Netziv was a tremendous mechabev. He loved the land of Israel. There was a Russian importer-exporter named Vysotsky. He said, Vysotsky, I want you to open up a tea company in Israel. And he said to him with as much respect as he could, Bista Meshuggah? In Israel, it's hot. They're not going to drink hot in Israel. He said, what do you care? You'll give Parnassah to Jews in Israel. So he coerced him. He felt he couldn't say no to the Netziv. It was the Ottoman Empire. And then came the Russian Revolution. Vysotsky escaped, you should pardon me, with just one or two pair of underwear. He didn't have a penny. Then the Ottomans left, and the British took over Israel. And the British loved tea. And Vysotsky didn't have a penny, except for the Vysotsky Tea Company, which made him a wealthy man. We're almost there. And then history repeats itself. In the 1950s, Golda Meir came to America. Ben-Gurion came to America. Ben-Gurion, of course, was named after the airport. He came to America, and he sold bonds. Now, a bond is a loan. This is very clever. He's not asking, it's not a schnarr. I'm selling you a loan. And he was in New York, and he traveled to Havana. And he sold a lot of Israeli bonds. Then came the revolution. Whoever could escape Cuba without a penny to their name. And there was a law enacted in the Knesset to enable these Havanian Jews to redeem their bonds early so they should have what to live. And lastly, Golda Meir came to America during the Yom Kippur War, and there was a dinner in her honor in the Ritzy Hotel, Waldorf, named after Israel, of course. They made a dinner in the Waldorf, and this is what she said to the people at the dinner. Quote, "My country has been invaded, and it's very possible we can be pushed into the sea. If your grandparents had turned left instead of right, you'd be living in my country. Now we need your help. I don't have time for you to go home and think about it. I don't have time for you to consult with your tax advisors. I don't have time for you to go leave it in your will. I need it right now." And Golda raised $300 million that afternoon.
Wow.
My image as a little boy, I'm 27, but my image is of one of my youngest memories during the Six-Day War, of kids standing in front of subway stations with Israeli flags, people dug into their pockets, blood money, boys are bleeding in Israel, tossing the coins into the flag. It was bulging, they emptied it into a bucket, filled it up, emptied it, filled it up. So the Rambam devoted his life to convincing people that they had it within them to do better than those who came before them. Step by step, rung by rung, because there's no express elevator to the top, we can improve ourselves in the world. Giving should not be an afterthought, which nations do after they do damage, and should not be to assuage our guilt from our excesses or indifference. In the end, we're measured by not what we have, but by how much we give. Because in the world to come, they don't want checks, they want receipts. And Charlie Harari just said that all the wisdom comes from taxi drivers. I'm going to add, not just taxi drivers in Israel, also ice cream sellers. So this is from last week from an ice cream seller in Netanya. There was a very wealthy man, a gvir, who told his wife, "When I die, my love in this world is coffee. Just make sure you throw me enough money, I can buy coffee in the world to come." So at one point she distracted the Chevra Kedisha and she tossed in some bags of money. He gets to the world to come. He takes out these crisp $100 bills and he goes into the store. He said, "I want a cup of coffee." So what do you got there? "This $100 bill." "That doesn't work over here. Over here we don't take money, we take receipts." And so it is in spiritual ascents. The road to the top is rung by rung, enriching the climber every step of the way. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I have some books.